Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 1st, 2006. Our focus today, a few days before the July 4th holiday, is on the American Way, and we look particularly at immigration and economics, two key factors in the U.S. Here's what we have coming up for you. In our first hour, Making Waves interviewer Damon Thomas talks with members of the New Hampshire Immigrant Rights Task Force about their work and current issues facing immigrants in the U.S. Our second hour begins with Morally Bankrupt, a program which looks at the way the U.S. economic system has been keeping women and people of color poor for 230 years. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news you need to know. Published on June 24, 2006, in Foster's Daily Democrat, the Dover Six arraigned. Dubbed by supporters as the Dover Six, peace activists arrested last month for trespassing at U.S. Rep. Jeb Bradley's office pled not guilty to charges of criminal trespassing, a Class A misdemeanor, in Dover District Court on June 23rd. For them, the issue is not whether they broke a law by refusing to leave a private office. William R. Woodward, one of the six facing charges, said, "We feel there is a higher legal issue, the legality of this war." As part of a statewide peace effort, Woodward, along with five others, were protesting the Iraq War outside Bradley's office on May 31st and were arrested after 5 p.m. when they refused to leave the office. On Friday, June 23rd, a crowd of about 30 peace activists, many holding placards and flyers stating, "Not one more death, not one more dollar, out of Iraq now," followed the five before their arraignment in a march from Henry Law Avenue past Bradley's office and to the courthouse as a show of solidarity. Supporters packed the courtroom as each of the five pled not guilty to the charge in front of Judge Stephen Morrison. The Dover Six will stand trial on August 21st at 1 p.m. In addition to the Dover Six, Macy Morse was also a member of the Newington Five, a group of activists arrested for trespassing at Senator Judd Gregg's office at Pease International Tradeport in October 2002. "I'm serious about doing actions that will prevent war," Morse said. David Diamond, an activist from Dover who was in the Newington Five, said the actions he and others have taken to protest the war have been worth it. Judging by honks and supportive words, he has seen a gradual but dramatic increase in support for their anti-war cause since beginning outdoor vigils and protests in 2001. "If we can stop this war 1 minute sooner than it would have stopped otherwise, it's worth it," Diamond said. From the Interpress Service on June 24th, "Rebuilding Not Yet Reality for Fallujah." 1.5 years after the November 2004 U.S. military assault on Fallujah, residents tell of ongoing suffering, lack of jobs, little reconstruction, and continuing violence. The U.S. military launched Operation Phantom Fury against the city of Fallujah, destroying an estimated 70% of the buildings, homes, and shops, and killing between 4,000 and 6,000 people, according to the Fallujah-based non-governmental organization, the Study Center for Human Rights and Democracy. The Interpress Service found that the city remains under draconian biometric security, with retina scans, fingerprinting, and x-raying required for anyone entering the city. Fallujah remains an island. Not even the residents of the surrounding towns and villages, which fall under Fallujah's administrative jurisdiction, are allowed in. Security badges are required for anyone wishing to enter the city. To obtain a badge, one has to be a Fallujah native from a certain class. That is, if one is from Fallujah and a government official, a high-class badge of grade G will be issued. There are B for businessmen and C for those who have contracts with U.S. military in the city. Lastly, are the R-grade batches, which will not be admitted through the main checkpoint at the east side of the city and must seek entrance through second-class checkpoints elsewhere. Having entered the city through the main checkpoint, the first thing visible is the destroyed homes in the Al-Askari district. Virtually every home in this area has been completely destroyed or seriously damaged. Across the Euphrates River from the city sits Fallujah General Hospital. Built in 1964, the hospital was unable to function during either U.S. siege because it was being occupied by the U.S. military. Doctors are reluctant to talk unless promised anonymity. One doctor said, "It is more a barn than a hospital, and we are not honored to work in it. There is a horrible lack of medical supplies and equipment, and the Ministry of Health is not doing much about it," added another doctor, also speaking on condition of anonymity. The people of Fallujah are struggling to survive amidst skyrocketing unemployment, lack of supplies, and ongoing violence in the city. At a grocery market, Haji Majid Al-Jumali, 64, who was a blacksmith before his hands weakened, asked the grocer how much an item cost before saying, "I only have 2,000 dinars, less than a dollar and a half to spend, and I don't know what to buy with it. Everything is so expensive, and my 9 family members must be fed." His 2 sons were killed by random gunfire from the new Iraqi army 2 years ago. "Now I have to take care of their 2 wives and 6 children as well as my wife." The market was full of people, but poverty is obvious from the way people wandered about trying to balance what to spend with what they have in hand. Ali Ahmed, a 17-year-old student, said, "We do not need press releases in this city, sir. What we really need is a solution to the everlasting problem of this city. The Americans and Iraqis in power accused us of terror, killed thousands of us, and now they are just talking about reconstruction. Well, they are all thieves who only care for what they can pinch off the Iraqi fortunes. Just tell them to leave us alone, as we do not want their fraudulent reconstruction." Ahmed added that the U.S. military continues to kill and arrest people for any reason whatsoever, and sometimes for no reason. There was great frustration that at least 30% of the allocated reconstruction funds were shifted to pay for extra checkpoints and security patrols in the city. In Fallujah, security has eaten up as much as 25% of reconstruction funding, but even more has reportedly been siphoned off by corruption and overcharging by contractors. Last year, a U.S. congressional inspection team was set up to monitor reconstruction in Iraq. On May 1st, they published a scathing report of the failure of U.S. contractors to carry out projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The report also noted that nearly $9 billion in Iraqi oil revenues, which had been dispersed to ministries, was, quote-unquote, missing. An NBC News exclusive entitled, "Insurgents Offer to End Attacks for 2008 U.S. Exit." 11 Sunni insurgent groups have offered an immediate halt to all attacks, including those on American troops, if the U.S. agrees to withdraw foreign forces from Iraq in 2 years, insurgent and government officials told the Associated Press on Wednesday. The groups who've made contact have largely shunned attacks on Iraqi civilians, focusing instead on the U.S.-led coalition forces. Their offer coincides with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's decision to reach out to the Sunni insurgency with a reconciliation plan that includes an amnesty for fighters. Nasir al-Ani, a Sunni Arab politician and official with the largest Sunni political group, said that al-Maliki should encourage the process by guaranteeing security for those making the offer and not immediately reject their demands. Al-Maliki, in televised remarks Wednesday, did not issue an outright rejection of the timetable demand, but he said it was unrealistic because he could not be certain when the Iraqi army and police would be strong enough to make a foreign presence unnecessary for Iraq's security. In Washington, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said that President Bush's, he said, "view has been and remains that a timetable is not something that is useful. It is a signal to the enemies that all you have to do is just wait and it's yours. The goal is not to trade something off for something else to make somebody happy. The goal is to succeed," he said. 8 of the 11 insurgent groups banded together to approach al-Maliki's government under the 1920 Revolution Brigade, which has claimed credit for killing U.S. troops in the past. All 11, working through intermediaries, have issued identical demands. The total number of insurgents is not known, nor how many men belong to each group, but there are believed to be about 24 insurgent organizations in Iraq, so the 11 contacting the government could represent a substantial part of the Sunni-led insurgency. The 1920 Revolution Brigades, an umbrella for 7 other groups, was established in the so-called Sunni Triangle north and west of Baghdad shortly after the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. Its name refers to Iraq's historical fight against British colonialism. The leader said in a telephone interview with the AP, "If they set a 2-year timetable for the withdrawal, we will stop all our operations immediately." The man, who refused to give his name for security reasons, spoke from the telephone of one of our mediators. Others present made similar remarks. Coinciding with al-Maliki's attempts to bring Sunni Arabs to the bargaining table, U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad held talks Tuesday in Saudi Arabia with King Abdullah. The Saudis have influence with many Sunni insurgents in Iraq. For al-Maliki, reaching out to the Sunnis risks heightening tensions in his ruling coalition of mostly Shiite Muslim political groups. Al-Maliki is said to be increasingly disenchanted with the close ties between the country's most powerful Shiite organization and Iran, which is ruled by a Shiite theocracy. That was an NBC exclusive report, and we'd like to note that the term insurgency versus resistance was their choice, not ours. Following up from a story we brought you last week, here's this June 29th update on Weapons of Mass Destruction Here, Plowshares Indicted on 2 Federal Felony Charges. On June 20th, 2006, a Roman Catholic priest and 2 veterans of military service went onto the E-8 missile silo in North Dakota. Greg Borch Obed, Michael Wally, and Carl Cabot used hammers to disable the lock on the personnel entry hatch that provides access to the warhead, hammered on the silo lid, painted "It's a Sin to Build a Nuclear Weapon" on the face of the 110-ton hardened silo cover, and poured their blood on the missile lid. Immediately upon arrest, the 3 were held on county charges. On June 29th, the Plowshares activists were charged under the following: U.S. Code 1361, Depredation of Government Property, and 2155, Sabotage. Their next court date will be a bond hearing on July 5th. They will appear before Federal Magistrate Judge Charles Miller at the Bismarck Federal Court in North Dakota. If convicted on both charges, Carl, Mike, and Greg face up to 30 years in prison. Carl Cabot, in a phone call from prison, said, "It is our faith to uphold God's laws and our duty and responsibility to stop this government from threatening to use or using weapons of mass destruction. We call for the conversion of each and every weapon." The resistors said in their statement, "We have chosen to start the process of transformation and disarmament by hammering on and pouring our blood on components of the Minuteman III nuclear missile system. We believe that the concrete that goes into making missile silos would be better used for building homes." That's it for news. But before moving on to our first interview segment, we would like to share with you this action alert from United for Peace and Justice. United for Peace and Justice condemns Israeli attacks on Gaza, calls for an end to U.S. support of the Israeli occupation. 10 months ago, Israeli military forces withdrew from the Gaza Strip, part of the Palestinian lands long occupied by Israel. On Tuesday, June 27th, the Israeli military launched an assault on the people of Gaza, and there seems to be no end in sight. The destruction of vital bridges and power stations, which led to the cutoff of electricity and water for well over 1 million people, is nothing short of collective punishment imposed on a civilian population. Israel has also taken nearly 100 elected officials and leaders of the Hamas party as prisoners in the last few days. Israel's massive military assault on Gaza is clear evidence that Israel remains the occupying power of the Gaza Strip, despite its unilateral withdrawal of settlements last year. Israel has been seeking to bring down the Palestinian government by bringing pressure to bear on the civilian Palestinian population, and is using the kidnapping of an Israeli soldier as a pretext to do that. United for Peace and Justice condemns this brutal attack and calls for an end to U.S. support for the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, including the Gaza Strip. To learn more about this issue and to learn actions that you can take to help, see the website www.unitedforpeace.org. That was Yearnin' by Inanna, a women's drum group from Maine. And now, as we explore the American way and freedom a few days before July 4th, let's go to Damon Thomas, to speak with the New Hampshire Immigrant Rights Task Force.
Welcome to another interview segment on Making Waves, Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Damon Thomas, and I'll be your host for this segment. With me today are two very special guests who are working with the New Hampshire Immigrant Rights Task Force. I have with me Lily Mesa and Eva Castillo, both of them are in the studio today. And they're both going to give their insights on the issue of immigrant rights and what's happening both statewide and regionally and nationwide. There have been several significant developments in terms of immigrant issues and rights throughout the nation in the last 3 months, and both Eva and Lily have been a part of that, both locally and regionally. And I'd like to welcome both of you to the show today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eva. Thanks, Lily. And I'm wondering if either one or both of you could tell me a little bit about the New Hampshire Immigrant Rights Task Force, what it is, where it is, the type of work it's involved in.
The Immigrant Rights Task Force has been in existence for about 5 or 6 years. It's an informal group. We're not registered anywhere. We have no bylaws. We don't have any status. And it's made of volunteers from different ethnicities, different countries, and we're just interested in immigrant issues. We started working with the JACPAC, later to be the Tyson plant. A few of us that work in the community noticed that there were a lot of injuries in the Latino population and that they were being served badly. So we started getting together to see how we could address the problem. And since then, we've been meeting regularly and working on different issues.
As part of the work that we've done so far, we were working on the issue of the driver's license. We think there's some discrimination from DMV against the Latino community and some other communities as well. One of the issues is that the Puerto Rican people, they were not treated as citizens. They had to go to Concord to get their license. They couldn't get it in any local office. So for now, that's been fixed, so they can get their licenses in any local office. The other thing is that we found out that some licenses were marked different than all the licenses. It was kind of saying that these people were residents and not citizens, so they had a blue line under the picture. Those were some of the issues that we were trying to work with them. The other work that we done is we were in Concord at the State House giving testimony against the bills, the anti-immigrant bills that were coming out that were very, very bad for the immigrant community. They were very discriminatory, and we got rid of those.
Yeah, I'm curious about those. I wonder if you could tell our listeners what those bills were about, who sponsored them, or what exactly it was that they were trying to do with that legislation. Certainly some of the activity out of Washington has been very repressive lately. They've tried to come up with legislation that clamps down on how people can get into the country, even when other family members are living here. And there are always restrictive provisions on basic human needs and necessities.
One was that they wanted to get some different kind of license for the people that are not citizens. That we definitely cannot agree with that, because that's going to make things worse. You know, the whole thing about immigration is making people fear people that are different, that come from different cultures. So if we have the license mark as non-citizens, when the police stop any of us, they realize that they are not citizens, they might treat them different in all the consequences that that can bring. The other one that I can remember now is that they would deny any service to anybody that's undocumented, any service like food stamps and health care. But I think that was kind of ridiculous, because they never get any benefit anyway. Even if you are a citizen, but if you are a naturalized citizen, they are always asking you for more and more papers. There's no way that someone that is undocumented can get benefits. They were probably referring also to the kids that are born here from undocumented parents, but even if people don't like it, they are citizens, so they have the right to have benefits.
Another bill was seeking to enact the policeman to give him the power to ask for immigration documents, and that was defeated as well. Our base for argument was, you know, it's hard enough for us to come and report a crime when we come from a different country, because we really, basically, we do not trust the police in our own countries. So we come here to the U.S. and, you know, we fear the police. And if you are going to have the police asking for your documents, then people are not going to report crimes. If a woman is being battered, she's not going to call the police. So finally, that was defeated. I wanted to clarify one thing that's very important, and I think it's a big misconception that the American public has. Undocumented immigrants have no rights whatsoever to any benefits from the government. No, they have no right for cash benefits. They have no right for medical insurance. They have no rights for food stamps. They have no right to any type of assistance from the government. So I don't know where people have been getting this idea that these people come here to this country to live off the system, where in fact the system lives off them in a way, because they come here to work, and they come here to work in bad conditions and with significantly lower wages than a person with the right to work would have. So I don't know what the misconception is, but I want to let the public know that people, if you do not have documentation, you have no rights to access any type of state or federal benefit whatsoever. You do not work, you do not eat, period. Another one of the bills was trying to do the trespassing, to arrest the people that are undocumented for trespassing. And happily, since that problem was solved before when we had the cases of New Ipswich and Hudson, that decision that the court made prevailed, so those bills were simply thrown out.
I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the cases of New Ipswich and Hudson. The chief of police, I know in at least one of those towns, in New Ipswich, I believe, took it upon himself to arrest and detain persons who he suspected were undocumented immigrants. I think he said they were trespassing in this country, and he had a right to arrest them for trespass. It became a national controversy. Some places, this man was looked upon as a hero. There are, of course, many who would say otherwise. I'm trying to give our listeners some sort of background, because we have listeners who tune in from other states who might not be familiar with the New Hampshire cases. Can you tell us a little bit about those cases and the kind of response it got in your communities, in the Latino community and elsewhere? Obviously, you defeated the legislation. That was a good start.
Well, even before the legislation was defeated, when the cases of those young men that were detained for trespassing was heard in the district court, it was found to have no base, so they were defeated. And yes, you know, this, especially the chief of police of New Ipswich, took it upon himself to arrest people. And we were outraged, because the only way to determine whether a person is documented or not is by profiling. You cannot tell who's who unless you start tagging people that look different. So we were outraged, and I think rightly so, when the day that case was heard, we were all there, we all gave testimony. In fact, there were so many people that they had to put us in the bigger chamber where the whole house meets, because we filled the room and we were giving testimony for like 5 hours or so. I'm happy to report that the case was defeated. The point is, you cannot trespass on public property. Whether you carry with you a passport or a green card, it has no bearing whatsoever in this. Most of these bills were sponsored by the same people. You have two or three of the state reps that come over and over again, and if they don't get their way in one bill, they try to reword it in with a different name, and that's it. But it's basically the same concept, you know. So they're trying to just get rid of undocumented immigration. And this case in New Ipswich was very interesting, because humans have prejudices, and that's fine. You know, everybody's entitled to like or dislike whoever they want. But when those prejudices carry to the floor of our representatives, they have no room there. You know, our state reps are here representing everybody that lives in the state. So I don't think they should carry their own prejudices and biases when it comes time to pass legislation. And what this case, the trespassing case, did was open the door for people to express freely their biases and their prejudices. It made it okay. It's really sad that at this day and age we still have to talk about prejudice and racism in this, the most powerful country on earth. You still have not been able to conquer that barrier.
I would like to add that the chief of New Eastwick, she just said it, that he wasn't doing that by himself. He had another people behind him helping him, right? But we have this guy that is always coming here to New Hampshire, Tancredo. He's a congressman from Colorado. He's coming here to spread his hatred for people that are different. And he's always talking about how the American culture is getting destroyed and the language is not preserved and all that stuff. Anybody can search on the internet with his name, you will find out where is he coming from. Who is he working with? Whose groups is he getting support from? And it's really bad because it's something that is going on in the whole country. It's spreading nationwide. It's a really bad feeling against everybody that is different.
Has this anti-immigrant or anti-anyone who's different feeling increased after, say, September 11th? Have you noticed an increase in what you've observed in the last 5 years, ever since September 11th? Is your work any harder after that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Starting with the driver's licenses. I mean, right now it's a chore to do anything. If you have an accent, if you look any different, like I said before, it opened up the doors for everything. And the people that come to this country, they come here to work, especially the undocumented, the people that blew the towers, the terrorists. They all came here with visas. They all came here with money. They all came here in privileged situations. So they're trying to make equals out of undocumented immigrants and terrorists. Immigrants here, whether documented or undocumented, they're not terrorists. And not every single person that looks different or speaks with an accent is here trying to terrorize people or to kill Americans. You know, most of the people that come to this country come to work hard. They choose to come here and they pay their taxes and they pay their dues to society. They contribute to society. They love this country and they come here to enhance the culture and enrich the whole life in the States, you know. So I don't see why people have to be signaled out because they're different, but definitely the situation has gotten worse. And in a state like New Hampshire, where there's so little diversity, when it's still 94.5% white, to have people protecting themselves, trying to close their borders, you know, trying to keep immigrants away, is ridiculous. It really is. We've had immigration here, but they were all white before, and now that people from color and people from Latin America are moving, now is the time when they start resenting immigration. It just doesn't make any sense. Immigrants are not terrorists.
I would like to say to people that is listening to this show that they shouldn't believe everything that they see on the news. Some news are trustable, but not all of them, because they always come up with these things that just to justify the situation that is going on. So they always come up with something to make an excuse for the actions that the current government takes about the whole situation.
I wonder if we could just step back for a second and talk about, I think there was an attempt by some militiamen and all to seal off the border of New Hampshire and near Canada. Can you comment on that? Does that ring a bell? I think Lily is motioning me to say something.
Well, what I just said, it was in reference to that. They're talking about closing the border with Canada, right? And just right there, when they were talking about that, they caught these people. Who can tell us for sure that that was true, that they were there, that they were caught on the border of New Hampshire in Canada or up north. We don't know that. It's the same thing when they started talking about building a wall between Mexico and the United States. They caught some guy from Middle East, and they said he was coming through and he was a terrorist. We don't know that. So that's why I said what I said before.
The information that we rely on comes from the government. There are people in the government who want to put up the walls and change the rules and really legislate more discrimination. So the source of the information comes from some of the same people who are trying to get these things pushed through. And you do have to wonder about the timing. Is it coincidence? And what are the political motives for bringing these things into the headlines and for these things to make news at such a critical time when there's been such a movement across the country of people to stand up for their rights? And I'm wondering if you could comment on some of the things that people have seen in their TVs over the last couple of months. Has been wave after wave of marches all through the country. You've seen huge marches in New Hampshire and Boston of people marching for immigrants' rights. And I'm wondering to what extent you've been a part of that or what your observations are about all of that activity.
We did have our rally here in Manchester, and we had a smaller rally in Concord. Immigrant rights are just basic human rights. So whoever cares about human rights cares about immigrant rights. A lot of the people that come to these marches or these rallies, they really have no personal interest whatsoever. A lot of them are American. A lot of them really have nothing to gain from getting immigrant rights enforced, other than the fact that they're trying to do the right thing. That's it.
Now joining us in the studio is Pete Escalera. Peter is a community activist, a Latino, living and working in Manchester, New Hampshire. Maybe you can give us some idea of your sense of where the immigrant movement is going, both in New Hampshire, across New England, and across the nation. We've seen a great deal of activity over the last couple of months. I'm wondering if you can help people who will see these images on their TV screens to help make sense of this. What does this all mean? They're told by the mainstream media what it all means, but what does it mean to the people who are out there agitating, moving to change, the people who are out there whose lives are most affected by the things that these rallies and protests are talking about? And, you know, maybe some experiences from your own struggles.
Thank you for this opportunity of being here today and expressing myself. I am that type of person that I do like to express myself. I probably can't be able to speak for Congress or the nations or locally. However, I could give you my opinion, you know, in what I see and especially how I feel about the movement. Just a little insight about myself is that I've been here in Manchester for the past 18 years. I was born in Puerto Rico, in Ay Bonito, Puerto Rico, and I came to America as a young child and was brought up with my family of 13, Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, New York, and there as a young person is from the streets, from schools where I learned English and where I saw my insights. My first insights into what was happening in America was in the 60s when Vietnam was kicking, and I was in high school and I said, "What is this place, Vietnam?" Prior to that, to the 60s, my concept of war was that we go to Europe, particularly Europe, to Belgium, and we go into the trenches and we just fight back. War was the last thing on my mind. But unfortunately, it didn't work that way. It didn't work that way for 2%, actually, of Latinos, because 2% of the Latinos of the fighting forces in Vietnam, Mexicans, Colombians, Panamanian, Puerto Rican, Cubano, and they fought bravely in Incheon, they fought in Way City, they fought in the Tet Offense. They didn't run away to Canada, no. They went, either got drafted or enlisted into the services to protect the basic characteristics of America's Constitution. That's liberty, justice, and freedom. I wound up in the Marine Corps, 18 and a half. I was overseas. My brother was 19, and he was in Nam. I was in Okinawa. Prior to that, you know, I was very active as a young teenager in the civil rights movement, preparing buses and voters' registration at that time. So politics was always fashionable with me and very interesting aspect of my life. Seeing the civil rights movement, seeing the African-American calling for their recognition, America plays the game of tag. Every now and then somebody's tagged. Remember as a kid, not it, you're it. Latinos, you're it. Latinos are it, and the spotlights are on Latinos. Every time you turn around, it's something to do with Latinos. That's the situation we're in. Not too long ago, on a day without immigrants, America saw for the first time 1 million Latinos yelling and organizing. And that was not a perfect example of organization, but definitely a movement that still rings in the minds and the hearts and the ears of many Americans, because they have to answer the stuff. What is it that immigrants want? Why are they coming here? Why don't they go somewhere else? Well, what you have to ask yourself is, why did your grandparents come here? And they too were told to leave and go somewhere else. But they remain, because America is the place for opportunity where you could grow. And that's all I think that the majority of all the immigrants want, is to have freedom, justice, and food. There's situations in a lot of countries in Central or South America that if a lot of them remain there, they're going to perish. They're not going to make it. They're going to die. They'll swim the Rio Grande. They'll get run down, chased down by dogs, helicopters on them, vigilante groups firing on them and chasing them, just to come over here and work at the Olive Garden or any other restaurant or Applebee's, you know, to work there for $8 an hour so that they could send some money back to Mexico and survive over here. That's the way it is. You know, we're focusing on the innocent that are trying to get over here, and at the same time, they're not focusing on the illegal acts of drug trafficking that's coming in. There's a lot of illegal activity going on because we're spending our money incorrectly, in my opinion. Yes, something has to be done to protect our borders from terrorists. There's people who actually they hate America. When I say hate America, hate you. Hate you for what this administration and our government is doing towards the image of us Americans. We are not like this administration. I certainly am not. You go to any of those countries, a lot of people, you know, are hating Americans because of American policy. America has to wake up and start dealing with the problems, not symptoms, problems. Immigration, America deals with the border, but that's not the problem. The problem is in Mexico. The problem is in the government, both governments, and corruption. What happened to the economic development money that we sent to these countries so people could remain there and be prosperous there? Where's that money going to? Where's the money people are sending back to their countries? Millions and millions of dollars going back to countries where all these so-called illegal people are coming in. American money giving those countries more economic power because they're dealing with American money in trade. It's not in their best interest for that. It's not in the best interest for large companies to teach these so-called illegal aliens English. Because you teach them English, you got to pay them more. You teach them English, now you have an educated person working within the system. America has to wake up and start dealing with the problems, not the symptoms.
So I just want to add that on under NAFTA, CAFTA, and all those related, the situation on these countries get worse. The thing is that people need to look deep into this. The government here take the jobs from here, from the American people, and bring it down there to another countries because it's cheaper and because they don't have the same regulations. But that doesn't mean that these countries are going to get any benefit of that. The only people that get benefits of this situation is the big corporations. As I said before, they don't have the same regulations about labor laws and environment. They are not as strong as here about the environment, so that's why it's easier for them to bring their business there.
Eva, any final thoughts or comments that you'd like our listeners to remember?
I just want people to remember where their ancestors came from and just relax about immigrants. Just think about immigrants as human beings and just stop having all those divisive thoughts about people that come here from other countries. We come here because we love this country and this is where we choose to live, and we have a lot to bring to the community.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you for joining me here today on Making Waves. We've been listening to Making Waves on Portsmouth Community Radios. My guests have been Lily Mesa and Eva Castillo and Pete Escalera. And until next time, I'm Damon Thomas.
It's a mighty long road that my poor hands have hold. My poor feet have traveled a long dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. Your deserts was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked on your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground by the light of your moon. At the edge of your cities you will see us, and then we come with the dust and we're gone with the wind. California, Arizona, I made all your crops, but it's north up to Oregon to harvest your hops. Dig the beets from the ground, pick the grapes from your vines to set on your table, your light sparkling white. When did you come to America the free? Who are your ancestors? What is your creed? Who is the father and the son and the we? Where is the spirit that saw liberty? When did you come to America? Long, long before, when the world followed what? When did your hands burn like gold? The thing that made this land, your pride and your joy. When did you come to America? I came to help you grow, to harvest your crops. I came to build your roads, your cities and your thoughts. Say you don't need me, but you know what you.
Grind me, still dust I will be. This I'll defend with my life, it need be, for my pastures of plenty must always be free.
That was Lila Downs with Pastures of Plenty, This Land is Your Land.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.